Good morning, all, and welcome to our committee meeting. We are in a different room. I hope the clock is right as I think it is. I called the meeting to order and just give you a little bit of an outline of where we're going today. We have three bills on the calendar and lots of amendments for the third bill on the calendar. So we have arranged for a room tonight if we do not finish today, because we will finish the bill. So it's the choice of how fast we want to go or not. I've allocated no more than 15 minutes for each of the first two bills, so we make sure we have time for Representative Long's bill when it comes up. So with that, the first bill is Representative Fearman's, and I do see that he is here. Representative Fearman. And we understand that the microphones may not be working this morning, so speak loudly.
Testing?
That one does.
This one works. So, good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present the bill, HF 3438, which is a bill to require utilities to post information regarding the electricity rates on the utilities website, including the amount of demand charges, electricity consumed per kilowatt charges, and including information on the day of time and seasonal rates that affect those charges. Also, it would require postings to the Public Utilities Commission, and that the PUC would then post the rates on their website as well. So information and data is power, and transparency helps drive further evolution. I applaud the customer-friendly devices and services that our utilities engage in with our consumers. I personally have used many of these on their websites, which are very helpful. I used an energy audit years ago, which led to new windows, new front door, solar panels, and the list goes on. So further transparency and the help of the utility companies to help us save energy and regulate energy is all part of that process. But the most transparency, if we can have more transparency on pricing and understand those rates better, that too will drive improvement and help us compare what rates are across the state. So for those reasons, I'm presenting this bill, and today I have Annie Levinson as a testifier as well from the Citizens Utility Board.
Would you just like to move the bill? If you would move House File 34.
Oh, sure.
83 to be laid over.
Okay. I would like to move House File 3438 to be laid over, please.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me again today. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota's energy consumers. One of the most popular services that Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, provides is helping people understand their utility bills. The vast majority of the consumers who contact us want to save money on their bills. And in order to know how to reduce your bills, you really have to understand first what goes into that calculation. So we walk through with people all of the factors that go into a utility bill, which pieces that vary depending with how much energy they use, which pieces of bill a customer can control, and how they do that, so that people can start to understand the most effective strategy for reducing their costs specific to their households. And we know that there's significant potential for people to save money once they understand their utility rates and their programs and options. For example, the average household saves $150 in the first year after a brief consultation with our staff. That might not sound like a ton of money to everybody in this room, but it can be a meaningful piece for a household whose budget is stretched, and many people save a lot more. Rate information, of course, is not the only thing that's important, but it's a necessary foundation. People also need to know their utility rates so that they can plan. Costs can vary significantly from utility to utility, as can the way that these costs break down. For example, some utilities have a very low monthly charge and higher per kilowatt hour rates, while others are the reverse. Some utilities charge flat electricity rates, while others have block rates that increase the more you use. So for a family that moves to a new area, these can add up to big differences in monthly electric bills, even if they continue to use electricity in about the same way as they expect to. And if people can see how their bills will be calculated, they can eliminate some of the surprise in those first months. As I read House File 3438, I do believe that there are some technical language changes that might be appropriate, and I've discussed this with Representative Bierman and would be happy to work with him as the bill moves forward if there's an opportunity to make the language more precise to what the bill seeks to accomplish. And I understand that there are utilities that have probably some similar suggestions as well. I'd be happy to work with them. The bottom line is, from Cub's experience from working with consumers, we know that understanding all the elements that make up a utility bill is foundational to a consumer's ability to control their costs, and we're happy to support the transparency that this bill would bring.
Thank you. We have public comment. Mr. Dodge, would you like to come up?
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, and thank you for having me here today. My name is Robin Dagey. I'm the CEO of Stearns Electric Association. We provide electricity to members, about 28,000 members in central Minnesota, primarily in Stearns County, parts of Morrison, Kandy, Ohio, Todd, and Douglas County. And again, I appreciate the time this morning. I know you're very busy, and this is a busy time for you, but I just wanted to take a few moments and comment on behalf of Stearns Electric and rural co-ops in Minnesota. So the bottom line is, as a rural electric co-op, we're a not-for-profit organization. Our goal is to break even year in and year out with maybe a little extra for patronage to pay back to our members. So we operate at a fairly lean operation. And just to clarify, we are locally regulated by our elected board of directors, elected from our membership. So we have 9 directors on our board, elected by the local membership, and all pretty smart people, educated and upstanding members in their respective communities. So I report to 9 very good bosses. And so, you know, regarding House File 3438, you know, we did read through this, and I did read through this, and, you know, something we already do, you know, with just a mere 2 clicks, you can see what our rates are at Stearns Electric, and that's the case, I think, with a lot of the rural electrics in Minnesota. We have a one-page rate summary for Stearns Electric, and it's a process we go through not that regularly, but I think our last rate increase was 3 or 4 years ago. And so the way a rate increase works at Stearns Electric or any co-op in Minnesota, we look at our revenue, we look at our cost, and look at our rates. If we don't need a rate adjustment, we don't. If a rate change is required, it's fully vetted by our local board of directors, and also by the Rural Utility Service reviews that as well. And we take, you know, our members' economic situations into account. So we basically aren't budgeting for extra anything at our place. So, you know, when I look at House File 38, you know, we're already transparent with our members, transparent for people who are considering moving onto our lines. If they have a question about our off-peak programs and how to save money, it's just a phone call away or an email. And, you know, we're glad to talk to people. I get calls all the time from members, and if I can't answer the question, we have experts in our organization that can. You know, I guess with that said, you know, when I look at the reporting to the PUC, we already do some reporting to the Public Utilities Commission for our boundaries, map, service territory, and things like that. And, you know, this would just be one more thing we have to do. I know there's some other bills that have been introduced that would require reporting as well. So you know, the bottom line is we just don't have the staff to do additional reporting at our co-op or our utility. So, you know, it doesn't seem like a lot initially to, you know, print things out and email them in, but, you know, we'd have to put somebody in charge of that and make that someone's responsibility, you know, day in and year in and year out. So what I'm trying to say is additional reporting represents additional cost to Stearns Electric, and, you know, those costs we pass on our ratepayers. So, you know, I would just urge this group and this committee to, you know, reconsider this bill. You know, we already are publishing our rates, and most are publishing their rates on their websites. And just keep in mind that, you know, we are not for profit lean organization, and, you know, one more piece of reporting just means an additional cost for our organization. And I thank you for your time.
Representative Stasinski, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question to you, if you've heard through the association you belong to, are there, or Representative Bierman, are there currently any utilities that do not supply this information on their websites?
Would you like to answer that?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Stasinski, for the question. I've never stumbled on your name before till just now. I had it down. So, there's obviously, you know how many co-ops there are in the state of Minnesota. I've only checked on five so far. All five have it on their website.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. We have one amendment.
Be my amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce the A1 amendment. Again, I think just for what we heard this morning, the communities and the co-ops manage their utilities very, very well with locally owned and operated members, locally controlled board members. We heard even, and Representative Bierman has checked five out of five, we're doing what you're asking us to do. We don't need a bill to do this, I think, for the utilities and the co-ops. And so I guess I'm just asking a friendly amendment to my colleague, Representative Bierman, to accept to allow the munis and the co-ops to be exempt from this bill. They are doing it. They don't have the ability to absorb some of the extra costs to do these kind of things. They have found a way to do this without having a bill, so I'd appreciate you accepting this to allow rural Minnesota to not take on the same rules and regulations to reporting to the PUC that we're working so hard to keep them separate from. Their models are really working, and so every time I see a reach out again from the PUC to connect to the co-ops or the munis, I must take action, and I must ask you to not include them, because it's not something that they are able to do if they aren't already doing it. And if they are doing it, they're doing it in the way that they see fit without having the state telling them how to do that. So I would like to move that A1 amendment.
Representative Long, or Representative Bierman, did you want to respond?
Did you have a comment? Madam Chair, Representative Baker, thank you for the amendment. I looked at that and I was considering some of the issues that I've been thinking about, and as I've talked to more and more utility companies about, I looked at that and thought, well, you know, it's not so onerous when it's essentially, it's not something that has to be mailed out or stuffed in an envelope, and it's really a Word document. So where I'm at right now with this is, it's not really so onerous for the utilities to do that and to put it all at the PUC, where a consumer could go to one place and get kind of a range on it. So I'm not prepared to accept the amendment today, and I think that in talking with utility companies from, you know, the largest in the state to some of the smallest that I've spoken to, they're putting that on their website. It's there. It's a matter of a couple clicks to send it to the PUC, and then the data is there for citizens across the state to be able to access that and understand rates. So I would opt not to accept that amendment, because I don't think it's reaching that onerous level for the companies.
Madam Chair, just to reply to that, I guess Going back to the question, if they're already doing it, why is it that you feel the need to have the PUC involved in these smaller companies? I guess that's the question I want to get to, whether it's what you consider a very small ask to a big ask. And I think when something small starts, like a community solar garden, and it expands to what it is today, we have issues, and that's some of those slivers that go wonky on some of us. So I'm asking from even a higher global, what is it, why is it that you think the PUC should have more control over the co-ops and the munis? Using this one as an example.
It's not more control.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, it's basically, to me, it's transparency of the data, and it is about, it's not so much control as it is looking at public utilities as a public good and need for across the state. So I'm not putting it on the same, I'm not seeing it as the same as infringing on the co-op's ability to set their rates as needed in their own communities.
And final question, Madam Chair, to Representative Bierman. Is it that you don't trust them versus the PUC and how they deliver that open transparency? Because again, it sounds like they're doing the rates, but you don't trust, is it a trust level for you that the PUC will do a better job than the munis and the co-ops?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, thank you for the question, and it is not a trust level. I know these local communities, these local co-ops are people of the communities in which they live. They have the trust of their communities, they're voted in members, they have the trust of the community. So absolutely, it's not a trust issue.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski has the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've actually got a couple. Just kind of looking at this, what is the fine if they don't comply? Or where does this fall within that if the cooperatives or municipalities decide, you know, we really just don't have staff, you know, it's not going to work this year to do this, you know, what happens to them? And then I have a follow-up.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, there's no penalty, there's no police on this. This is, as I understand it, there is no enforcement that I'm aware of at this time. I think that the information is the fact that it would be made a statute and a law, you know, that is up to many of us to follow the law.
Madam Chair, Mr. Eloff, could you comment on that? Would you say that's correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, we're kind of replaying the discussion we had with respect to Representative Garofalo last meeting. The Department of Commerce is charged with enforcing the provisions of Chapter 216B, and they have a whole host of enforcement measures in their toolbox that they can use to do that. Of course, enforcement is always a discretionary activity on the part of an agency, and you can't predict what or what not they might do, but they have the authority to enforce.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, and just a question to Representative, we heard from folks that are locally elected through their utility with the commentary from the cooperative member that said that it would potentially be onerous. Have you had any conversations or any comments or letters from a cooperative or municipality that would speak to you? You said it wouldn't be, and the folks that do it said it would. Do you have any commentary from a utility, of a cooperative, or a municipality that say that it wouldn't be, that would agree with your position?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, thanks for the question. It's a very good question. Coming up to St. Paul, one of the things I did not want to do was put onerous regulations on businesses, small businesses. I have a small business. I understand that everything you do in a small business takes some time from somebody. But that was one of my interests in looking at the websites of the companies and seeing how they lay that out, especially for residential customers. And that's kind of focus I have is the residential customers. The documents on their websites are very brief, and if I think about my business, how I would be able to manage this, it's a matter of a Word document that would have to be submitted. It would take one of my people all of a minute or two to do that. So I haven't seen the level of complexity that would take. So that in itself, I mean, I think that it's a manageable task for co-ops that have thousands of customers, some of them. And some of them I know, I've learned from you that one co-op has 63 customers, is what I remember. So, I mean, their rates are something that is a knowable thing that's on their bills. They're posting them all the time. And if they don't have it on their website, they would put it on their website. If they need to create that document, it would take a little more time. But once they have it in place, we're just talking about updating it.
Madam Chair, just a final follow-up. Have you requested a fiscal note? Because obviously when you're doing work and you're making a report, there's someone that needs to accept that report. Have you had a fiscal impact request, or where is that sitting? I guess I look through this list here. It doesn't look like it's in this packet of materials that we
Madam
have.
Chair, Representative Swedzinski, I believe the fiscal note was something around $8,000 over 4 years.
It is in the packet.
Okay. Thank you.
We are laying the bill over, Representative Swedzinski. The last question will be Representative Groffler. Do you have the last question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, I think one of the things that is an important item to bring to this conversation is that the history of the Public Utilities Commission's interaction with our cooperative service utilities did not begin this year or last year. There was a hard-fought battle over who regulates net metering policies at the cooperative service territory level. The Public Utilities Commission has sought to inject themselves into that. It took a change in statute to clarify that, in fact, the member-owned cooperatives run their own policies. And so when you see the words Cooperative Service Territory and Public Utilities Commission, these agencies, these cooperative service territories, justifiably so, get very concerned. Let's keep in mind that as recently as a year ago, all members of the Public Utilities Commission lived within 30 miles of Minneapolis and St. Paul. There was no geographic diversity, and there was no ideological diversity on the Public Utilities Commission. So certainly the proposal you have before you may not be, to use your words, onerous, but I'm wondering if you could tell us two questions. Number one, is it your opinion that cooperative service territories should be rate regulated by the Public Utilities Commission? And number two, how many bills has the DFL introduced this year that would impose a new mandate or requirement on cooperative service territories?
Madam Chair, I'd like to call a roll call on the amendment, please.
Did you ask for a roll call?
Yes, on the amendment. Yes.
Okay. I think the questions have now become repetitive, so let us do a roll call.
Can I get an answer to my questions? No one's asked those questions, Madam Chair. There are two questions.
We can do that.
Okay. It's basic questions. Number one, I'll restate them.
I know. I have. Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, question number one was, should the PUC regulate co-ops price? Is that what the question was?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, should the Public Utilities Commission have the authority to rate regulate our cooperative service territories? And number two is, how many bills has the DFL introduced this year to mandate or require activities of cooperative service territories?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, question one, I would say no. And question two was, what was the question? Say that again. Sorry.
That's okay. Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, how many bills has the DFL introduced this year that would impose additional requirements or mandates on cooperative service territories?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I'll have to get back to you on that.
For the roll call, clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes no.
Representative Wong?
No.
Representative Swazinski?
Yes.
Representative Acomb?
No.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Bierman?
No.
Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Mecklen? Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
There are 5 ayes and 8 nays, 2 absent, and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Bierman, would you like to renew your motion? Delay 3438 over.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to lay 3438 over for future consideration. Thank you.
Lay over. All right, next up on the agenda is 3055, Representative Lee. Welcome to the committee.
How many votes?
The chair is going to move House File 3055 and ask that it be referred to Capital Assessment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members for the opportunity to present House File 3055. And Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment, an author's amendment to add the fiscal note, the appropriation of $399,000 to the Department of.
The chair will move the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. House File 3055, as amended, appropriates $399,000 from the General Fund to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to coordinate with other state agencies to assess the impacts of climate change, including the increase in heavy precipitation and storm events on state-owned assets, and to estimate the capital funding needs associated with these impacts. And the Commissioner must submit a report to the House and the Senate Capital Investment Committees. And Madam Chair and committee members, I am bringing this bill forward because this past fall, as the House Capital Investment Committee traveled over 3,000 miles across the state of Minnesota to tour and hear from Minnesotans in their hometowns about local infrastructure projects, one recurring theme was that of rising water. Stretching from the Red River Basin in the northwest to the Minnesota River in Mankato and in Shakopee, and the need for capital investment. All totaling over $114 million in requests from the DNR and local requests for flood mitigation and water-related projects. And to give you a historical perspective, I believe staff have put 2 sheets that I got from nonpartisan staff here about the Red River Basin I mentioned earlier. The total spending for flood hazard mitigation from 1997 to 2018 is about $368 million. And Madam Chair, these are significant capital investment for flood mitigation, and your committee has already heard from Professor Joe Magner at the University of Minnesota about climate change and its impact on water. And I haven't print this out for the committee, but I do want to mention an article that was printed in, from the NPR News talking about how cities are preparing their water infrastructure for bigger storms. And then in there it says that last year more than 20 places in Minnesota set annual precipitation records. That includes the Twin Cities and Rochester, Minnesota, where more than 55 inches fell. Minnesota is now about 5 inches wetter on average than in 1980. So, Madam Chair, we need to have the DNR assess the impact of climate change on state-owned assets in order for us to understand the capital needs associated with this impact. And I will end my testimony and turn it over to the testifier.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Carrie Jennings. I'm the Research and Policy Director at Freshwater. We're a nonprofit focused on empowering citizens to protect and restore Minnesota's water resources, quantity and quality. And I direct your attention to the colored handout in your packet. The first thing I want to emphasize is that I think it's sometimes hard to imagine scenarios that are different from today. But we can just look back to last June and July and look at a singular rain event, July 17th, where 2 inches of rain fell in a tropical way on the city of Minneapolis, flooding that area of Uptown on the map on the top figure. Cars that were parked along the streets in Uptown were bumping together and floating out of their parking spots onto the curbs, flooded up to their engines. Flash flood warnings were in many cities, where blue skies were in others. If you turn the page, you'll see, related to the same storm, the damage that happened on the East Bank campus of the University of Minnesota, where stormwater infrastructure was overwhelmed. Water flowed out of a flooded basement of a building on campus onto the street, created a landslide along the River Road, which shut down the light rail and the bridge over the Mississippi River for a few hours, and the bridge was, the lane on West River Road was closed for a long time. At this same event, also pressurized stormwater in stormwater tunnels, creating a geyser in downtown Minneapolis that popped a manhole cover off the street, and probably also pressurized the stormwater tunnels themselves, enlarging caverns that we know exist in the St. Peter Sandstorm that hold some of these stormwater pipes. So if you keep moving on, you'll see that hazard mitigation is being addressed at the county scale. We're also working with cities. I'm in particular working with the emergency manager of Hennepin County, Eric Waggy. He is a geologist as his undergrad, but also schooled in hazard mitigation through his two tours of duty with the National Guard in Iraq and Afghanistan. And his main goal is to figure out where the hazards lie and avoid those in the future, avoid risk to life and infrastructure. We have done for him some projects that identify precipitation-driven landslides in Hennepin County. We're now working on the collapse of bedrock infrastructure, like those stormwater pipes. And he is also interested in mapping the kind of groundwater flooding that's occurring in Chair Wagenius's district. These are pilot projects that have informed a statewide project that the LCCMR funded that I am leading, and that is to identify precipitation-driven landslide hazards in 5 other regions of the state. That's this map on the bottom. To date, we have identified over 8,000 precipitation-driven landslides in Minnesota in those 5 watersheds. So these are piecemeal approaches that I have put together out of concern, and I turn your attention now to just some scenarios in the recent past that affected state infrastructure. I decided to combine the places where state parks and state highways were impacted. And we start with the Duluth rain event of 2012, which took out Highway 210 for years and impacted iconic infrastructure at Jay Cook State Park. Below that is Upper Sioux Agency State Park, one that I visit every year. It gets harder to move from the park headquarters to the campground because of a slow-moving landslide that's driven by a high water table. Highway 67 is the one impacted there. And then if you turn again, closest to home is Fort Snelling State Park, which was unavailable to visitors most of the summer because of high water in the Minnesota River. And what you may not know is that those bright fuchsia and blue colors are places where landslides have happened in the past, right undermining Highway 5, which is the main route to get to our metropolitan airport. So I think it's very important that the state consider their assets and infrastructure in the new normal, and I included a graph at the bottom of the increase in just 2-inch rain events in Minnesota. Thank you.
Hey, Knuth, is one person signed up for public testimony? Okay. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for bringing up groundwater flooding. That is a new concept for us, and I think one we're going to have to get used to.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Kate Knuth, a climate policy advisor with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. MCA has a decades-long track record of bringing scientific and legal thinking to protect the health of Minnesotans and our environment. Echoing the previous testifier in many ways, I'm here to enthusiastically support Representative Lee's House File 3855. The committee well knows that climate impacts in Minnesota are well underway, whether it's 65% increases in 3-inch rainfalls in the last century or the mega rain events that have become, unfortunately, more common. These trends are already documented. They will only get worse. Well, we know climate change-driven disaster, weather disasters are already underway. We don't have a handle yet on how these disasters can be expected to affect our infrastructure, particularly how much these impacts will cost to prepare for and to recover from a public infrastructure perspective. Given, for example, the cost of disasters like the flood in Rushford in 2007 or the Duluth in 2012, these disasters already cost the state many tens of millions of dollars, or the Red River Valley with several hundred million dollars. We know the numbers aren't small. We just don't know yet how big they are. And it's not just these big, memorable rain events that we need to be concerned about. There's ongoing smaller disasters like roofs collapsing on barns, roads being washed out and covered by floodwaters for weeks on end. In Mankato, as a very specific example, a well that serves 30% of their city's drinking water needs a decade ago was 73 feet from the edge of the riverbank, and as of last fall is 15 feet from the edge of the riverbank. I've previously worked as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Minneapolis and also with the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. I've been thinking about fiscal impacts of climate change for years, and I've looked pretty hard for good studies of how much climate change impacts will cost the state. I have not found them. The science we need just doesn't exist. Without this information, our ability to have full, honest, financially sound public conversation about how to respond to climate change is severely limited. It's why I'm here today to support House File 3055. It's a good first step in the state having the information we need. In addition to the study of state-owned assets, I think the committee should consider looking at studies to assess climate change impacts on all public-owned assets, and I'm just actually not sure if state-owned means public-owned or if it's only looking at things the state owns. The state does not only have the state government does not only have responsibility for assets it owns. Local governments, as you know, come all the time to the state asking for help with infrastructure, and increasingly these acts are connected to climate resilience and climate adaptation. Local government alone quite simply do not have the financial ability to handle the climate impacts on their infrastructure alone without state or other help. And so the state needs to get a better handle on what these costs already are and what they can be expected to be in the future. I also think there's important questions about who should be paying the climate costs Minnesotans are already bearing with regard to climate impacts on public infrastructure. We're here to talk about climate change-driven impacts on public assets. It's not clear that the state or public entities in general should be solely responsible for paying these costs. Better understanding which entities in the state and beyond have profited from climate change while not paying all the costs we are experiencing is also worth consideration and study by the committee. So in conclusion, we support House File 35 at MCA. We look forward to supporting even more comprehensive studies and public conversations about the cost of climate change impacts and how we can pay for them and who should pay for them going forward.
Thank you. I see no questions, so I will renew my motion that House File 3055 be re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Long. Representative Long, did you want to do an amendment, and then we will hear from the remainder of those who were going to make public comment?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. We had the fiscal note come back since our last meeting. We have an amendment to reflect the fiscal note, and I would also like to make an oral amendment to the amendment to add in the dollars reflected in the fiscal note.
Well, if you would move that 3368 be re-referred, it was on the table, so be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, then we can work on the amendment.
Right, yes, I move that House File 3368 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, are we on the fiscal note amendment?
Yes.
Okay, I just asked for a roll call when we do get to that point. Thank you.
And then I'd like to offer the A21 amendment. And I'd like to make an oral amendment to the A21 to add in the amounts from the fiscal note. There are two agencies involved, Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. We made an edit that is on 1.3, lines 1.3 and 1.4 that will reduce the fiscal impact to the Department of Commerce from two FTEs to one FTE. So with that amendment, with that change, the oral amendment would be on line 1.8 after the dollar sign, insert $117,000. And the amount for the Public Utilities Commission is reflected in the fiscal note, which would be on line 1.12 after the dollar sign, insert $109,000.
Members, do you have that? Members have that? The roll call has been requested. Okay, we first need to be amendment to the amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? Okay, amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now we're doing this.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Swazinski?
No.
Representative Acom?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Bierman?
Yes.
Representative Bowe?
No.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Mecklen? Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Stevenson?
Yes.
It's 7 ayes and 5 nays. The amendment is adopted.
Should we take public testimony?
Yes, we should. And we have a list of those. Well, first Ross Abbey, and then if Benjamin Stafford would be on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for having me. My name is Ross Abbey with U.S. Solar. U.S. Solar is a 20-person solar development company with our main offices here in Minnesota. I'm here to speak in support of Representative Long's bill, specifically Sections 3, Subdivisions 1 through 3. These subdivisions represent a bicameral compromise, or an attempt to one, with support in both the House and the Senate majority. The effect of these subdivisions is to expand the community solar garden program into rural counties and districts, albeit in Xcel's service territory only, to increase residential capacity and improve the residential customer experience, and to adopt an annual cap on the number of new megawatts that can be built under Xcel's basic CSG program going forward. This bill does preserve the value of solar, or VOS rate. As Professor Gabe Chan testified on Tuesday, this means the new value of solar gardens will not cause any net increase in ratepayer bills. It is also true, as Mr. Evans said on Tuesday, that the VOS rate often exceeds the cost of the project. At least it does for projects that actually get built. And that's kind of just by definition. You wouldn't build a solar garden that costs more than the rate that's being offered by the utility or by the state. And that's incidentally why you don't see solar gardens on rooftops in a lot of parts of the state. And that margin, the value above the cost of the project, that's what allows this program, and this bill in particular, to be a win-win-win for Xcel ratepayers, for CSG subscribers, and for rural farm owners. First, ratepayers win under this program because it has enabled Xcel to easily surpass... I'm sorry, I didn't realize there was a time limit. I'll move quickly. It enabled Xcel to easily surpass its 1.5% solar energy standard, something Xcel said at the time would be very hard for it to do, and it's been done using non-utility and non-ratepayer dollars at a very low risk to ratepayers because all the risk of project failure is on the developers. Second, let's not forget, Xcel customers in the same feeder as the CSG, they're the ones that get the power. Whenever the sun shines on that 10-acre, 1-megawatt array, it's those customers that get clean, zero pollution, the locally produced energy, with no additional cost to themselves. At the same time, we're also, developers are paying to upgrade the utility infrastructure, again, using no repair dollars or utility dollars. It also benefits voluntary subscribers under the bill. We had good testimony on that the other day. I just will point out this bill will allow somebody like the St. Paul Public Housing Agency to access more gardens. Instead of having zero participants in their last RFP, they might see four, five, or six suppliers under this bill. That does allow subscribers to shop around on price. You might think that would be negative for developers, but we think the ability to build new CSGs and serve even more subscribers more than offsets that. Finally, there's real urgency with this bill because the benefits it would bring to rural farm owners and rural districts. Up until now, you've only really been able to build these gardens in and around the metro, which means rural farmers are not getting the benefit of hosting these gardens, getting a 25-year lease payment, and being able to diversify and stabilize their family farm operations. We've got a couple letters that were submitted in the packet, one from Gary Wirsch, president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, speaking to the urgency, another from 14 farmers across, I think, 11 different districts speaking to urgency. There was testimony last year in the hearing from the farmer as well. Finally, I want to speak to the cap. I know it is somewhat controversial, but it's also part of the potential compromise between the Senate and the House on this part of the bill. When the statute first passed in 2013, the legislature did not set a policy cap because it didn't want to arbitrarily limit the market size. But we now know, 5 years in, that the size of this market is about 100 megawatts to 250 megawatts built each year. So I think that gives us some comfort that we can adopt a cap that will allow Xcel to plan for these new megawatts, allow Xcel to go to the IRP process at the commission, and know what other solar they need to bring online to meet their overall goals. I have more prepared, but if we're short on time, I think I'll rest with that.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Benjamin Stafford and then John Reynolds.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Stafford. I'm the Director of Policy and Public Affairs for Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. We are an industry-led nonprofit organization dedicated to growing and strengthening Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. Our membership is comprised of 40 clean energy companies and growing, ranging from startup businesses to Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies, which employ thousands of Minnesotans across the state. More simply put, we're sort of the business voice of clean energy in the state. I'd like to thank Representative Long for bringing this bill forward. I'm pleased to be here to support House File 3368. Several of our member companies develop and install community solar gardens across the state. We believe modifications in this bill are part of this continuing discussion and the program's success in providing local clean energy benefits while stimulating job creation, investment, and economic growth. SEEM also would like to note that we're appreciative of the leadership of Xcel Energy in demonstrating and undertaking a significant effort to diversify and transform its clean energy options for customers. SEEM, alongside Xcel, understands the need and importance of maintaining a diverse mix of technologies within their portfolio, including solar energy, in order to achieve ambitious corporate policy-driven goals for clean energy. Furthermore, as electricity grid continues to change and modernize, demand for technology solutions at varying scales, including both local and utility scale solutions, will also increase in order to meet the wide-ranging needs of our power customers in the state. We also want to ensure that we have a strong future solar workforce and expertise here in state as we continue to work towards a clean energy future. SEEM notes that a number of our member companies work to bring the economic benefits of clean energy to landowners, their neighbors, and other energy customers. We support this bill for three reasons. First, we support the removing of the contiguous county restriction because it places an unnecessary barrier on development. Second, advances in technology and innovations are driving down the cost for renewable energy. And third, each of these installations is carefully negotiated with local farmers to best use their land in responsible ways for the long-term benefit of the landowners and for energy customers in the state. We have over 61,000 Minnesotans working in the clean energy industry. 4,917 is our exact number of solar employees, and we want to keep our clean energy jobs growing at a fast rate. The future here is bright for clean energy. Minnesota is currently a national leader in community solar gardens, and this bill can help us retain that title. and we want to make sure that happens. We encourage stakeholders to continue working together in order to identify shared solutions to deliver on those community solar garden goals and removing barriers to clean energy development across the state.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
John Reynolds and then Alan.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Reynolds. I'm the Energy Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber is a statewide business organization that represents businesses of all types and sizes, as well as 500,000 employees throughout the state of Minnesota. A few weeks ago, this committee heard from how a number of Minnesota businesses are committed to sustainability goals and emissions reductions plans that go farther and faster than any state mandate. This includes creating innovative products and services to help others reduce their energy use and achieve climate goals. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on HF 3368, which we view as a significant expansion of Minnesota's community solar program to the detriment of ratepayers. When the program was created in 2013, the economics of solar energy were substantially different than they are now. Today, as utilities and businesses and others move toward voluntary carbon reduction goals, community solar is among the least cost-effective methods of procuring solar power, and the cost to ratepayers is significant, over $140 million more each year compared to market rate energy, and nearly $130 million more than large-scale solar. It's important to remember community solar isn't the only way for businesses or other customers to procure renewable energy. It's just one of the most expensive means. And if the goal is to achieve the greatest increase in renewable energy for all with the least cost impact to ratepayers, we urge the committee to rein in the costs and embrace the most cost-effective solutions for all ratepayers. So, thank you.
Thank you. Alan Gleckner and then Andrew Snow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Gleckner, and I'm here on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a Minnesota-based, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to advance clean energy policy that works for all Minnesotans. We appreciate the opportunity to share our support for Representative Long's proposal to advance the community and distributed solar market within Xcel's service territory. Fresh Energy worked with Xcel to develop the company's community solar program, and we actively supported its passage into law in 2013. Over the last 7 years, we've learned a tremendous amount, and the solar market has evolved significantly. When the community solar law was passed, Minnesota had about 14 megawatts of solar installed. Today, we're at about 10 times that. Clearly, the market is now in a different place, and we see value in further exploring where the opportunities and gaps are for the 2020s solar marketplace. And we appreciate the Delete All Amendment to House File 3368 as a solid first step in that direction. In addition to forward-looking updates to Xcel's existing community solar program, the bill addresses the distributed solar market more broadly. Minnesota's solar businesses and workforce are poised to deliver the next generation of small-scale, low-cost solar energy for Minnesota consumers that is a necessary piece of the puzzle towards a carbon-free electric system. We look forward to engaging in the conversation regarding this market segment as it moves forward this session. We particularly appreciate the addition of the community access community solar proposal in this bill. A major lesson learned from the current program is the importance of ensuring equitable access to community solar subscriptions, which has not been the case thus far. As one of the early champions for community solar, Fresh Energy is committed to ensuring that the program is available to and serving all customers within Xcel service territory. As such, we see this as a critical element of any program changes that move forward. In general, we look forward to working with Representative Long, Xcel, and other stakeholders on a package that updates Xcel's community solar program while building the distributed solar market in a fair and durable manner. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Andrew Snope will be the last one.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Snope. I represent the members of IBW Local 292 in Minneapolis, the electrical workers. Our members perform work installing and maintaining community solar gardens all over the state. The installation of solar systems have benefited our members. The developers our members have worked for, including U.S. Solar, and we thank them for working with our contractors. They prioritized highly skilled, educated electricians that are able to get the job done on time, under budget, and without any problems on the install. That isn't always the case with all developers who have come into this market area to take advantage of the community solar garden program. As we make the transition to renewable carbon-free power development, we would like to see higher emphasis to help create good jobs with high wages and high benefits. Maybe to take a small bite out of the economy of good jobs being lost by replacing the jobs in the legacy power generation industry. We would advocate for addressing the requirement of prevailing wage for workers who are building out our renewable, carbon-free energy power development. Prevailing wage would help to assure that developers are paying local area labor wages and benefits, further assuring that our state, that out-of-state developers, contractors are not undercutting our local Minnesota contractors who are bidding on these projects. As an Xcel ratepayer myself, who is paying to subsidize the rate of community solar garden energy purchases, we would like to know that our brothers and sisters in the electrical industry are not having their wages and benefits undercut by developers and investors who are capitalizing on a higher energy rate paid for the community solar garden energy output. The IBEW provides training to workers who are for a career in the electrical industry. Solar is a portion of that portfolio of the training we receive in our careers. When one aspect of our industry experiences a slowdown, another part of our industry, which are trained, may be experiencing an upswing. Our career training helps to even out those industry declines. Again, as ratepayers, we don't want to see subsidy, we don't want to see that people are able to take advantage of workers by exploiting lower safety and training standards. We are not advocating for higher energy rates to accomplish our goals. We are advocating for a larger piece of the pie in the economy, which is being created by the development of renewable carbon-free energy. We are hoping that when you think of renewable energy development, you think of creating good jobs. We are hoping we can continue to work with Representative Long to craft language to better reflect higher worker wages, benefits, and continue training and supervision standards for installation projects that will be incentivized with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Swazinski, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question to the testimony. So under this current language, you say that it doesn't stipulate whether or not these solar projects should be prevailing wage or not?
No, not in this bill, and currently in law, there's no stipulation for prevailing wage.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, what are your thoughts? I mean, are you thinking about adding that to the bill, or didn't we do that last year, or what happened to that portion?
Thanks for the good question. Yes, we're Mr. Snope and I are actively working towards that end.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Members, we left off with questions for Xcel, and I have a list of folks. Able staff does. And so we would ask Xcel to come up, and the first question was from Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Evans. I just had a quick question. There's a number of amendments posted today that repeal the community solar program in its entirety. Looking at the 817, there's a few others. But have you had a chance to review those amendments, and does Xcel support eliminating or ending the community solar program in its entirety?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have had a chance to review the amendments. What we're trying to do, and we actually have been involved in this for the last couple of weeks, is meeting with solar garden developers. Our next meeting is actually this afternoon, to try to find some kind of way to preserve the program, preserve aspects of the program, preserve the jobs, and preserve the niche market that some of these developers have carved for themselves in our service territory, while at the same time getting rid of the what we consider to be extreme inequities and inefficiencies of the manner in which this energy is priced, and in the manner in which that price is passed along to our customers, and frankly, in the manner to which the profits are shared primarily outside of the state of Minnesota. So we are, we weren't going to get up and take a position on any particular amendments. We would like to find a way to continue this mid-level distributed energy marketplace for the companies and the jobs that exist for them, but you know, the trade-off here in terms of inequities and inefficiency is just too much for the benefit of those things, and that's the position that we're taking moving forward. And we are having some luck, either not luck, I guess, we're working well with the developers to try to find the middle ground, to find some way to preserve the jobs and the economic development without the severe inequities.
Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, thank you for that answer, and thank you also for your work in trying to find that middle ground with the developers. I appreciate it, and I know the committee appreciates it as well.
Representative Baker's next.
Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, I had a couple questions from our last mass meeting here. You had mentioned, well, somebody had mentioned, maybe it was you, about kind of the fuel adjustment clause on the bills and what was sort of driving a lot of that. And somebody mentioned a third party that's causing that to be lumped in there. Not being an Xcel Energy customer, whether it's a third party, I don't know if that's what you were referring to or if somebody was. What I was trying to kind of understand was then, as the fuel adjustment clause on everybody's bill is sort of, I think, one line, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I was looking to see was this, have you, does Xcel Energy identify what that third, and I might be using the wrong line of word of provider, but it's a third source, or it's a outside source, or something that is not directly related to your costs of producing energy, but you are taking this energy, and maybe we call it that third wheel, if you will. Is that something that Xcel Energy would ever consider putting on the bills for their customers to see what that outside influence is to their utility bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, I think I understand your question. If I don't know if anybody has the handout that I gave last week, earlier this week, has this little chart at the bottom that shows the fuel clause. So just so you understand, on our customers' bills, there's several aspects to the bill. One of them that everybody talks about are the rates that are established by the Public Utilities Commission. Those rates help us recover the costs of operating the utility plus our authorized rate of return based on a very common rate case. Traditionally, in utility billing, you have not included fuel costs in the rates because fuel costs can be very volatile, and so the device that's been used in Minnesota for a very long time and in most other regulated states is a fuel clause, which allows us to pass the cost of fuel through to our customers. If the price of fuel goes down, our customers get the entire benefit of that. If the price of fuel goes up, our customers pay the entire price of that. So that's the traditional fuel clause, and it's why it's called the fuel clause. If the price of coal to run our plants goes up, we pay more. That's passed through to our customers. You get that. So in more recent years, we and a lot of utilities have acquired more and more of their energy, not from plants that we own, that we fuel, but rather through power purchase agreements. So an independent power producer, who I think is who you might be referring to as the third party, typically in response to a request for proposals, we might put out a RFP that says we want to see 100 megawatts of natural gas power, or we want to see 100 megawatts of wind, or 100 megawatts of solar. We would put that out, we would get bids for that, and then again, under the PUC supervision, we don't get to just go sign these contracts. We have to take them back to them. We would sign a contract with them, and usually it's like a 20-year contract or a 25-year contract, and the price would be negotiated based on their bid, and we would, and in those cases, what's being passed through the fuel clause is not fuel, it's just the PPA, the price we're paying for the energy. So we don't mark it up, we don't mark it down, it touches us only in the sense that we collect it from our customers and then pass it on to the independent power producer. So if you look at this little chart that I presented last time, things like coal and gas and nuclear we don't own any biomass, a little bit of a mixed bag, but coal, wind, or gas and nuclear, that's actually the price of the fuel that we pass through to our customers. Things like wind, solar gardens, and hydro, we own some hydro, but we also purchase a lot of hydro, and that's what most of that is. Those are actually the contract payments we pay for the energy that are passed through to our customers. So in the case of most wind, the other solar, and the hydro, Those are typically a response to an RFP and a negotiated price that's supervised by the Public Utilities Commission. What sets Solar Gardens apart is that that is not a price that's negotiated or based on cost or based on the typical things that we use to measure what's passed through. It's the value of solar that's established by law that we pay, and it's simply passed through.
So, Madam Chair, thank you for that clarification. That seems like it is it's an outlier, if you will, with not a negotiated price, but a cost value of solar, if you would. Does Xcel Energy have the ability to, if they wanted to share that information on their utility bills, or is that also one of those things that has to go through the PUC to, every time you make kind of a change in your bill, does that go through the PUC, unlike what we see in our munis or co-ops? They can do a lot of that locally. I just don't know your process if you were to ever share that to your customers. Do you have the ability to do that or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I guess I don't know. I mean, I think we could. I think we could put a bill insert in, or we could somehow print it on the bill, sort of a breakdown. You know, it changes every month because the price of these things, particularly of the fuel, changes every month. I don't know if anyone from the PUC is here. They would know better than I whether we would actually have to have permission from them to disclose that. I don't think so, but if I'm wrong, I'll let you know.
And final question, Madam Chair. There's a community solar garden kind of a graph here that I see that has your name on it. It's 2019 bill credits. I don't understand it. I don't know if it was in our packets. It looks like this, Mr. Evans. So I don't know if we got that or if you could help me understand what the $107 million in bill credits means. I'm having a hard time following this.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Baker. Yes, this is a graph. I actually brought it on Tuesday. I decided not to use it in my presentation just because I was running out of time. But in the meantime, a member of the committee actually has asked me for the information that is shown on this graph. So you might remember that on Tuesday I had this graph that shows the pass-through of money from the three different boxes, from our customers to the subscribers to the owners of the solar gardens. And that doesn't attempt to reflect any proportionality for how much money, you know, how the money flows. So what this chart that you have, what that shows is sort of is the split. So in 2019, the total amount of credits that we paid to subscribers was $107 million. So that's the amount of kilowatt hours produced by solar gardens multiplied times the value of solar rate gives us the amount of money that then we place as a credit on this. You know, the value of solar arrow on this exhibit is the credit that's placed on those customers' bills. But as I explained, the subscribers don't get to keep all that money because they have to pass it through to the owners. And so what this attempts to show, and please note at the top where it says this is an estimate, and I'll explain for a minute why that's an estimate. What this attempts to show is out of that $107 million that passed through in 2019, about 10% of it stayed with the subscribers, and the rest of it was passed along to the owners. And so the reason this is an estimate is because, as I think I noted on Tuesday, this transaction is not a regulated transaction, and it's not necessarily disclosed. As I also mentioned, we own, an unregulated subsidiary of Xcel Energy owns 17 megawatts of solar gardens. So we know in those transactions how much the subscribers keep and how much they pass on to us, to our unregulated subsidiary. We also know from promotional materials that we see from other solar garden companies roughly what the percentage is. But just to be clear, I cannot represent to you that this represents the proportion for every solar garden, even for most solar gardens. I can just tell you that this is for the ones we've seen, this is roughly the proportion.
That's very helpful. Even knowing it's an estimate, you know, and again, as an owner yourself, Xcel Energy makes a profit on your megawatts of power that you have on a solar garden, and you've got that kind of identified here. Is this something that, knowing that 90% in your estimate likely goes back to the community solar garden operators slash developers or whoever has the ownership at the end, maybe. Is that something that someone in the Department of Commerce would also be tracking, or is this something that we could get maybe this firmed up so we know, or if there's anybody in the audience that could confirm or not confirm this? I think this is an important thing to recognize, where the actual bill credits are going.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, first of all, I want to make clear, and I tried to do this on Tuesday, I want to make clear, we do not represent that this big bar over on the right represents profit, because these owners and operators have to run the solar garden.
Thank
so
you.
They have to maintain it, they have to pay their financing on it, they have to handle the transaction with the subscribers who are sending them money.
I should use the word revenue instead, maybe.
Yeah, I think, the important, and I don't believe, I could be corrected, but I don't believe the Department of Commerce or the PUC has any way of tracking this transaction. This is an unregulated transaction. It's between the subscriber and the owner, how much they have to share. And it's not the same in every solar garden. It's not even the same for every subscriber. If you're a corporate subscriber, you probably get to keep more of the money than if you are a residential subscriber. We know that to be true in some cases, because you're less risky. If you're the investor over here in the owner box, you like to have those corporate and large customers because they're less risk and you're more certain you're going to get paid. So like any other business transaction, you'll give them a better deal in order to attract them as your customers.
Thank you.
Representative Swazinski, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of get it, I mean, there is folks from the Department of Commerce if they wanted to come forward, but it's kind of interesting. It seems to me, we have public utilities and we have regulation, and we have groups of people, within the PUC that regulate, that overlook this. The amount of bills that we've seen to regulate, to insert themselves into municipals and into cooperatives, the amount of bills. But there's, I don't know, is there any bills from the majority that would regulate this relationship, which is, it's essentially a quasi-private entity within the public realm of investor-owned utilities, essentially. But within that, there's no relationship. I mean, does the Department of Commerce have any wish to look over this relationship?
I'm happy to answer that question, Representative Swazinski. So in this bill, we actually have some consumer protection language, which is attempting to get at some of the relationship between the subscribers and the community solar companies. So we are trying to help with adding some additional regulation.
Okay. Representative Boas last.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, I've got a couple of questions that I jotted down from earlier this week. What is the price paid per kilowatt hour for industrial solar versus community solar gardens?
Madam Chair and Representative Bowe, on the handout that showed this bar graph,
okay,
kind of gives you an indication, the blue dots at the bottom being the market prices that we're seeing. I think that shows it at about 40 cents, or I would say $40 a megawatt hour, 40 cents a kilowatt hour, it's the same number. And that's about what we're seeing as we start looking around the country and looking around the state for what we would, I guess, call grid scale. That is something we're going to attach to the transmission grid. Grid scale solar is in that range, and we actually have seen some contracts around the country at $35 a megawatt hour. And again, our resource plan projects that by the middle of this decade, this will actually be our cheapest resource, and it'll get down below the wind price, down in the hopefully $25 to $30, $35 a megawatt hour for purchased solar.
So I'm hearing a new term now, which is the value of solar, and I'm trying to make an apples-to-apples comparison. So how do those rates compare to, like, retail retail rates for solar versus value of solar?
Well, I guess I'm not entirely sure what a retail rate of solar means, but what I can tell you is the value of solar for 2020, it's adjusted every year, the value of solar for 2020 is $115 a megawatt hour. And we believe that we could go out on the market and buy that in the $40 a megawatt hour range. And when I say we could buy that, we could buy solar. There are some economies of scale. There is some reason why solar gardens will tend to be more expensive, even based on cost, than utility-scale solar. But it's we don't believe anything like the discrepancy we're seeing in the price here.
Okay. So the blue dots here on this chart. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, just to follow up too, if you're asking the difference between the applicable retail rate and the value of solar, Professor Chan also addressed that on Tuesday. The applicable retail rate was used for the first couple of years of the program. The value of solar is a lower cost than the applicable retail rate.
A lower cost. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Do you have any more questions, Representative Ball?
I'm just trying.
Representative Ruffles is next.
Oh, I'll be real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the blue dots here represent like the market price for solar, is that what I'm understanding? Or?
That's the wedge.
Oh, okay.
That's the wedge stuff.
The blue dots represent what we think we could go out on the marketplace and get an independent power producer to bid to build solar energy for us. We think this is the ranges we're seeing in the marketplace.
So as we want to get pricing down, I mean, that seems the best place to put our efforts. The community garden solar, just because of the vast difference in the pricing between the two.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, yes. I mean, if you're looking for the most bang for your buck in converting the system from fossil fuel to solar, you would definitely look there.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll start by asking a rhetorical question, and that is anyone on the other side of the aisle listening to this stuff? I mean, you are expanding a program that right now screws low and middle income ratepayers and transfers the money to big businesses. That is what is happening right now. Those are the facts. They are not in dispute. And the DFL's response to this program is to expand it and supersize it. So keep in mind, the debate we're having in front of us today is not about whether we want to clean up the grid. It's not about whether we want to reduce pollution. It's not about whether you want to have the jobs be local or outside the state. That's not the debate. The question is, are you going to have all those benefits be cost-effective for ratepayers, or are you going to have those benefits be super expensive for ratepayers? There is no environmental benefit for community solar versus grid-scale solar. There is no environmental benefit for community solar versus wind development. This is simply a transfer of money from low and middle income ratepayers to large businesses who can put a sticker on their label saying, look at us, we're green, and by the way, we're making everyone else pay for it. I would hope somebody here is paying attention. I am thankful one person who is paying attention is Senator Osmak. He gave me permission to say this because he just texted it to me. He is so infuriated by the debate today, he's pulling the Senate bill, and he's returning the bill to the author. He gave me permission to say that and sent that in a text message to me. So we can sit and talk about this more, but this issue is dead for this session again, as it should be. It is ridiculous that we have a complete lack of awareness about the financial consequences of what is happening here. And again, the debate is not over whether you're pro-pollution or anti-pollution, clean energy, anti-clean energy. It's simply about forcing ratepayers to pay more money for something that has equal economic and environmental benefits at a lower cost. Listen to what Mr. Evans said. Okay, Xcel doesn't make any more or less money off this program. They could give two rips about that. What is happening is the ratepayers are getting screwed. Top to bottom. And there seems to be a complete lack of mathematical recognition or awareness from the majority party that they even care about it. So maybe that's my question, Madam Chair, Representative Long. Do you care that ratepayers are getting screwed and paying so much money?
I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on whether or not this is a cost shift, because the value of solar is not a cost shift. But if Senator Osmak is interested in trying to work together for a solution, that's what I'm trying to do. So pulling the bill leaves us with the status quo. If Senator Osmak would like to help work towards a solution, then I hope that we can continue to work together with a solution, as Xcel is doing productively with our solar developers as we speak. And if the minority is interested in working towards a solution, then they will help us advance this bill so we can get to a conference committee so we can try to negotiate a good outcome that will help stabilize the program for the long run.
Madam Chair and Representative Long, there's not going to be a conference committee. I just told you Senator Osmak's pulling the bill today.
Well,
maybe we should take a step back here, and maybe we can at least agree on some basic set facts. What is the community solar garden cost on the fuel and tax clause for Xcel ratepayers right now? What is that? How much? What is that amount of money? What is the? Because we have this information. What is that dollar amount?
I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, do you happen to have a figure for last year?
Well, the figure I have is the one that's shown on this. The bill amount of bill credits given to subscribers under this program was $107 million.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, so $107 million. Mr. Evans, if we took that $107 million and we put it out as an RFP for clean 100% renewable energy, would we have more renewable energy or less?
Madam Chair, Representative Glaffo, I believe we'd have more.
Right. And Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, just to restate this, because these are the facts, people should not have any dispute over this. If that's the case, why would there be more renewable energy if there was an RFP process for it, if there was a competitive process like we do everything else? Why would there be more renewable energy?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, I mean, we believe, and it's really the basis of all the energy we acquire, that through a competitive bidding process, competing companies will drive prices down because they will shave their costs and they will shave their profit in order to win the bid. If they're just going to get $115 a megawatt hour regardless of what they do, then there's no incentive. I mean, I guess what I would, you know, I go back to Professor Chan. I went and re-listened to his testimony, and it's really very interesting. I recommend everybody do it. He talked about the growing wedge, because the cost of solar is going down, but the value of solar is going up. And this wedge in between is the overpayment, in my opinion, that our customers are making. And Professor Chan actually said, it's a policy choice where that money goes. You can give it to Warren Buffett, or you could use it for some other purpose. But as that wedge grows, this is our growing concern.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, and Representative Long, the items we've just discussed in the last 5 minutes are not in dispute. There's no disagreement on the cost that this is being borne by ratepayers, that who's paying for it. There's no dispute on who's getting the benefits. We can disagree about how much of the benefits big businesses are getting or how much the developers are getting, but that's where the money is going. And for the life of me, I do not understand why an element of our rate structure, which, by the way, this incentive was never put in law. For those who want to take the stroll down Amnesia Lane, this is what happens when regulators put in an uncapped subsidy program. We end up with this mess. So we have this problem. It's happening right now, and the DFL's response to it is to put the foot on the gas pedal and to make it worse, to hurt low-income ratepayers even more. Folks, the big businesses are going to be fine. All right, particularly energy-intensive industries, they're going to do what has happened in other places. They're going to shut down their operations here and move out of state and move to places that have lower power prices. They're going to be fine. But the low-income ratepayers, they can't go anywhere. Okay, they're stuck. And to at least at a minimum acknowledge the flaws in this program, as opposed to putting your foot on the gas pedal, it may be advantageous to at least have a conversation and at least understand the subject matter. But I am thankful for the fact that Senator Osmak is pulling this bill. I'm very thankful I got to break the news to the room. So we'll see where this conversation goes. But members, you have to get a grip on this program. It is a complete economic disaster for ratepayers, and it's only getting worse. Thank you.
Mr. Evans, I did not see a question for you. I think the questions are over, and we are ready now for amendments.
With respect, if the minority thinks this bill is dead, perhaps they can withdraw all their amendments and we can just move this on to Ways and Means as is. Is that something you would consider, Representative Garofalo?
Madam Chair, Representative Long, unlike the DFL caucus, we don't play follow the leader politics. We think for ourselves.
Okay.
So I can't speak for everybody else.
Okay.
Then our First Amendment is A20, and I believe that's Representative Bakers.
It is, Madam Chair, and thank you for, again, allowing me to bring a new amendment to the table today. I'm also, just for the committee, I am withdrawing amendments A17 and A4, just so that we can kind of pass those on. It's kind of, let's make a deal with Representative Long after our last meeting, so thank you for visiting with me about this, Representative Long. And I got this idea really after listening to some testimony at our last meeting, and there was some good things in the bill that that I wanted to talk about. And I guess I was more moved with one of the testifiers, Mr. Timothy Denherter Thomas with the Cooperative Energy Futures, about his co-op model. Really struck me as how I envisioned a community solar garden to work. It's a member-owned co-op. It is a for-profit model. And so when I heard that, and I saw that on that garden, their rules are 50% have to be residential, and I think that is kind of the intent of what this was meant to be. So I wanted to draft a bill, and at the time I didn't know if they were profit or non, so I just said, let's put the bill together as a for-profit corporation, or if you're a non-profit, let's do this thing that allows you to have a different plan in place. So again, we could allow them to use the value of solar for the member owned, and then have a lower rate for the folks that are for profit. I want to incentivize the smaller operators, the co-ops like Timothy had, and I wanted to sort of maybe set them aside. Also, with that, Representative Long, I wanted to put in here again that a single payer on that kind of a model would not be more than 20%. I think currently it's 40%. Because I don't have this worded exactly right because of the profit nor profit, I think I meant to do more of a member, non-member. I'd like to work with you on this to make it better if you would accept this sort of an idea to, I think, not kill the program, but to modify it how I think it was meant to be at the beginning. And it's still, which I think is, it's supported by that company. And I think that we could call up somebody from them if you wanted to hear from them. But I'd like to propose that to you as an amendment to look at this bill moves forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. I appreciate our conversations, and I appreciate your support for the community access projects. And thank you for signing on to the bill we introduced yesterday that would codify that language. I can't, unfortunately, support this amendment because it limits it to for-profit corporations, and I want to see as much low-income solar built as possible, and I don't think we should limit it to just nonprofits.
Well, I do hope that we can look at this further, Madam Chair, because, again, that model is one that we can and should get behind. They should be able to get the full value of solar reimbursements. They should be able to, because it's helping residents the most. Those are the kind of models I think were the intent of that bill at the beginning. This is where I think this has gotten out of control. I'm committed to still working with this as it moves forward, so I'm disappointed you won't support it. I hope the rest of the members will.
I see no phone. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
And then it's not adopted. We have a 12. Is this Representative Long's amendment?
No.
I believe that's mine. Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A12, I'd like to move the A12 amendment. So the A12 amendment is actually pretty straightforward. From the conversations that we've had from 2013, the tidbits here and there, I have not been able to look back, but this program has grown out of proportion compared to what was actually thought. What was it? I mean, maybe to some people this was the plan was all along, but the excessiveness of the program, the expense of the program, just looking at the shouldering cost, the sheet that we have here, that in 2020, solar gardens account for 21% of the costs and 3% of the energy produced for the market.
you know, it'll be interesting. You know, XL has some dockets before the PUC, essentially that shouldering where they're looking to shut down coal in the fall and in the spring on their own because they have the ability to do that without legislative approval. And what that's going to do, that this will be the most expensive portion of the portfolio and likely bring in the least amount of energy for that high cost. As Representative Groffalo said so eloquently, that this is not about, you know, coal versus, this is about expensive solar displacing cheap solar. And I think sometimes the best thing to do, you know, working on the farm, when you got a field full of weeds, is to dig it under and start again. And, you know, I don't think anyone expected that it would be as large as it is, that it'd be as expensive as it is. And I think this just kind of gives us a clean slate to continue this conversation. We're not saying that it needs to go away forever, but I think starting a good, firm foundation and starting anew, and I'd appreciate your vote. Thank you.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This repeals the community solar program, and I oppose it.
I see no further discussion. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Members, I think we will do A2. Who offers that? There's no one to offer a...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, that would be me. I'm just trying to get my notes together. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much. The A2 amendment is to repeal and replace it talks about the 30 megawatts per year. My amendment wants to make sure that we put some limits on this thing. This also allows for a 5 megawatt capacity. It shows there's some wiggle room. I think this is what also Representative Long was talking about, where Xcel Energy is trying to work with some developers on finding a better way. It lowers the cost a bit. It does put some limits on this, but it actually helps work with getting the transmission and a distribution side of solar a little bit cheaper. Cuts out some of the costs of the value of solar, and I think it's a good bill to move this conversation along. It does save ratepayers some money, so I'd appreciate a supportive vote on the A2 amendment.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This repeals the community solar program, and I oppose it.
I see no further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. I see A1 is next.
They're
an author for A1.
Chair, I will move the A1 amendment forward. And the A1 amendment, I think, is really designed to delete the new language, which is creating a community access program. I'm just not sure how the new program will work any better than the community solar program was before.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bowe, I respectfully ask that you withdraw this amendment. I think the Community Access Project program is widely supported. It's got bipartisan author in the House, and Senator Rarick is the author in the Senate. And I'm hopeful that this is one area where we can all agree.
Let's take it forward for a vote.
Okay. Well, then I oppose the amendment.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Groffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One for you. What time are we going to be recessing from committee today?
We will recess until 4 or 15 minutes after session, whichever is later. We will be in room 5. We can go there now. We can recess after this amendment. Might want to plow through a few more. It's up to committee members.
Hopefully we recess after this amendment, I know. So, Madam Chair and Representative Long, the sections that Representative Bowe is seeking to delete, that language in the bill, what problem is it attempted to correct or solve? What is that language attempting to accomplish?
Sure. I spoke in length about this on Tuesday. The Community Access Project is designed to help deal with the need to help get more projects that are targeted at residential customers and particularly low-income customers.
Madam Chair and Representative Long, and the reason why that's not happening now is because why?
Those projects are more expensive to build. When you are working with more residential customers, it's more difficult, and so community solar developers tend to go with larger operators like schools or large public entities as well. And so this would help provide an additional benefit if you are building for 51% residential customers.
Madam Chair and Representative Long, so is it in the previous statement I made, I said that, you know, big businesses are disproportionately benefiting from this program right now. Is that correct?
I don't believe so. The we have 18,000 individual subscribers in the program. They're the majority of the subscribers. We have a number of schools that are benefiting, public entities that are benefiting as well. Companies that are benefiting can also purchase in different ways, but are choosing to purchase through the community solar program. And as I mentioned, the value of solar rate is designed so that there is no cross subsidy. So I don't think a disproportional benefit is a fair statement.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, it was supposed to be a softball for you just to acknowledge the deficiency of the program. You just said that there's an incentive to have mass solar gardens with fewer customers, and you're correct that they are going to government entities and nonprofits, but they're also seeking
out. You said big businesses, and that's not just big businesses. Public entities as well can benefit. I am trying to help this get to more residential customers.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, Representative Long, yes, I'm acknowledging that you did point out that we have schools, the Met Council at wastewater treatment plants, stuff like that, but these businesses are going out, they're seeking out large businesses to make up the composition of the customer base as well.
So Representative Garofalo, I hope you would oppose this amendment then so that we can keep in the community access project, which is trying to get towards residential customers, which it sounds like is what your goal is as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, what I'm trying to do is trying to get members on your side of the aisle to pay attention. My point is that if I am telling the members that businesses are disproportionately using this program, that this is transferring wealth from low and middle income ratepayers to big businesses, they're not going to listen to me. But if you acknowledge it, then maybe they're going to be more likely to believe what are the facts. So when you had said that there's this incentive in the current program to go out to school districts, to go out to the Met Council, government entities, and churches, that same incentive exists for those entities to go out to big businesses. This was supposed to be a softball for you to acknowledge that, yeah, this is a problem. No one intended for it to happen. The program wasn't designed this way to result in this wealth transfer. It was simply an acknowledgement to get you to acknowledge that, yeah, this is a problem. This is why we're putting this in there, to try to correct that problem. That's all I was asking. And if you could just acknowledge that's a problem, that would be helpful.
I didn't agree with the way you framed the question. I think we are trying to achieve the same goal, which is to make sure that we are allowing more residential customers to participate. And if that's our shared goal, then I think the A1 amendment should be withdrawn, and we can work towards that goal.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Long, I'll ask it in a softer way then. Is it a problem right now, the number of large businesses that are utilizing the community solar program to their financial benefit?
I don't think it's a problem, but I would like to see more residential customers get access.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, why?
Why is it not a problem? Because I think it's good to have more solar, and I think that it is a benefit to our state to have more solar developers and more solar employees and more low-carbon energy in our state.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, if the number of residential customers is unacceptable right now in the community solar program, why is that?
I didn't say it was unacceptable. I said I'd like to see it expanded. I'd like to see there be more residential participation in the program. I do think that the program was intended to benefit more residents, and that's been harder than we anticipated, and this is designed to help reflect that.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Long, I was actually trying to make the case for you because there is a problem here, right? The circular reference of, well, we're here to expand residential access to the program. Well, if we're trying to expand access, what's happening with the current composition of ratepayers? And there seems to be an acknowledgement that this is happening with local units of government, Met Council, other nonprofits, but there seems to be almost a level of denial of how big businesses are abusing this program to transfer their electric costs to ratepayers. And I don't know why there's a resistance from the other side of the aisle to acknowledge this is happening, but I would hope that perhaps in future conversations you would, you know, to use a word, not be a science denier and acknowledge this is happening.
Representative Swazinski.
I'm good. Thank you.
There's an amendment before you, members. The author opposes the amendment. All those in favor say, wait a minute, the author of the amendment, the author of the bill opposes the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted.
Madam Chair, could I move for a recess?
Just hang on.
Okay.
That's what I was going to do. But I want to let you know before we do that, that there are 13 more amendments, and we will work through them all, and we will get the bill done this evening. So we are in recess until 4 or 15 minutes after session.
We're room 5.
Welcome back, members. I want you to know that there are 13 amendments left, and we will stay until we get them done. Plan your time accordingly. We left off with Amendment 7. Representative Long, will you renew your motion that 3368 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means?
That is my motion.
Thank you, Representative Long. We have Amendment 7. Is there anybody going to?
Go ahead.
We're going to withdraw 8-7.
We'll withdraw that amendment.
How's that looking, Madam Chair? One for one.
Nice.
Take one off, huh? All right.
Is Representative Garofalo arriving?
He's not. We don't think so. We're going to skip it.
Okay, and we have an amendment coded A5.
Madam Chair, that would be mine, and I would like to introduce A5 to the author.
Representative Baker moves amendment A5.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask the author to, I want to repeal the contiguous county rules. I think that if you want to expand this and triple it and make it bigger, you got to play in your own sandbox. I think you just need to stay in those areas. So I would appreciate accepting A5.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A5 amendment would appeal or remove the agreement that was made on the 100-foot setback and the 10% requirement. Which was passed in the Senate in a bipartisan vote, so I would oppose that.
Representative Swizinski.
Madam Chair, is this the A5? That's the.
He's looking at the A3.
Oh, I have A5. Is that what?
Yeah.
But the setback one is A3.
I think you moved the A5. Anyway, yeah, I just want to speak on behalf of the A5 if that's the one we're moving. I think. In part, we heard from even some of the testifiers that were testifying on behalf of this bill that talked about, the reasons for, the community solar program was essentially so that you could be part of it and be right next to you. And, just understanding what this program has become, being obviously led with the corporate interests, with the bill to a vast extent of it, outside ownership from across the state, I think it's important that it stays at least as close as possible, and I think to the folks that are prescribing to it. And I appreciate Representative Baker's attempt to remove this section of change from the original agreement that would allow it to be contiguous. I don't believe it forces it to be within the exact county in which the vast majority of the prescribers are from, but it does say it must be at least adjoining. And I think that's a proper place for that. Being that it is about community and it's about being able to see it and enjoy it for what it is. And so I would ask you to support Representative Baker's amendment.
I see no other discussion. A5 is before you, members. The author of the bill asks you to vote no. All those in favor of A5 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No. No.
The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment up is A3. Is there anybody who wants to do that?
Madam Chair, I have the A3. Is that the 1,000-foot setback?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this one is similar to that. I think I wanted to briefly explain to my members here why I think this is an important one. Right now it's the 100-foot setback. I am asking for a 1,000-foot setback for gardens, not to I think it was by being near residential buildings or something. So back in Canandaigua County this last summer, I had an issue with a farmer who passed away. His other younger family moved into this home, and there was a solar farm that was going to be created in front of their home. They have a long driveway, and as you can imagine, rural Minnesota, these long driveways are a long ways. And a solar farm community developer came in and made a deal with the farmer. There was very poor communication with the person who purchased their parents' home, their older farm. They had renovated it. They were very angry that this new solar farm was coming to their front door. They were 100 feet off of their driveway because they didn't have a lot of land around this building, this farmstead. And they are now going to be looking at an 11-acre solar farm for the rest of their time that is in the south side of their home. It's the only really visual they have outside of their front window and their new deck that they had just built a year ago on this home. And now they get to look at this when it gets built next year. I went through the process with them. I went to the county planning and zoning. I urged them to not do this project because of what it was going to do to their sight lines. It's a good deal for the farmer that was who sold the land or who developed rented the land to this group. I just realized firsthand these are ruining landscapes in rural Minnesota when you live there, and even the developer had admitted they did a really poor job communicating with this family. It made me realize a 100-foot setback is simply not enough. I'm just asking for 1,000 feet for this when it comes to getting close to residential homes and things. With that, I hope that the chair will consider these kinds of things because it's reasonable. I don't think the intent is to hurt families like this that I walked through. We were not successful in the end because they had to follow state law and their local zoning, but I know they're looking at trying to make this not happen again. I would hope that the author would see this as a reasonable request.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The current language requires a minimum setback of 100 feet. Local jurisdictions could certainly require greater setbacks, but this was compromise language that passed in the Senate last session, and so I oppose the amendment.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and I think as part of this bill moves to move these projects away from the metropolitan area, and this amendment allows at least some local control to, have state standards. We've been working on trying to create some state standards for 5 years here when it comes to the siting of these places. And I would just ask each of you members, imagine, essentially being surrounded like Representative Baker's constituents. Having this that close to your house and not being prescribed, here it is, it sits. We're all about, folks being able to utilize their land and the way they want. It's their farmland. That's what their right is, too. But, it's also an investment and a responsibility to rural homeowners as well. And, I think setting some strong standards when it comes to siting these and really – forcing these folks to really look at, what is their commitment to folks that live in rural areas. And I bet if you went to your neighbor, any of them, whether it's rural people or relative, and said, hey, would you like this 100 feet away from your property line, 100 feet away from your whatever that might be, what would they say? And I understand what the special interest, I understand that, this was maybe some language that was dealt with the Senate, but I'll bet a lot of those folks don't have one of these things going in their backyard. And I think this could be a strong statement that you send to developers that let's be good neighbors. I think that's a perfectly good, reasonable ask of this, and I'd ask you to support it.
Members, I see no other folks on the list. A3 is before you. The bill author asks you to vote no. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
In the opposition, say no.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment before you, members, is A14.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move A14. A14 is a DE, which is pertaining to Section 4. When Representative Long originally went through his bill, I think that was Tuesday morning now, he pretty much skipped over Section 4 as far as when he described through everything. And the section adds power purchase agreements to the list of, you know, the proceedings of the subject and the environmental costs reviews by the PUC. My question to Representative Long, does this open a door to new lawsuits with, like, North Dakota, by chance?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mecklen, no, it doesn't. The Public Utilities Commission in their fiscal notes said that they already are assessing environmental costs for power purchase agreements. The goal, though, of this is to make sure that the costs aren't a zero value and that they are included in the Public Utility Commission's evaluation, and it felt important to include in here given the broader context of the value of solar and trying to help level the playing field for all energy sources to make sure that we're including environmental costs.
We don't see anybody else on the list. Would the author of the bill suggest you vote no?
That is my suggestion.
I see no other discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition, say no.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment is A6. Is someone going to offer A6?
That's you. That would be me.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the A6, this amendment prohibits the out-of-state corporate ownership of community solar gardens. You know, we've heard several times now that the Omaha billionaire Warren Buffett's corporation is the largest single owner of solar gardens in Minnesota, and I believe we all have this flyer that Excel passed out showing 87% of all this is owned by somebody that lives outside of Minnesota. And we've heard testimony the other day that we want to make programs so the lesser advantage can afford this stuff, but yet it's the wealthy out-of-state and out-of-country people that seem to be the ones that are buying into it. So this amendment would correct that, and I would hope you would take that into consideration.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mecklen, I will echo your concerns about litigation on this amendment. Discriminating in this way against out-of-state company ownership is a violation of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, and so this would be unconstitutional and would subject us to considerable lawsuits. So I would ask us to oppose this.
Representative Swisinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, our state doesn't always shy away from, you know, making decisions when it comes to energy production that causes potential lawsuits. But, you know, I think this is
can we call that an encouragement?
I don't know. But I think, you know, as we look at these things, you know, this is a potential failure. You know, from when this this bill was initially moved forward in 2013, it was not. I mean, no one has said this has been the intention of the developers of this program that say, hey, you know, we want 87% outside of state ownership with this. You know, when a product themselves, when a bill is sold to the voting public that says this is a community, well, is community Warren Buffett, is community, you know, foreign owned assets? You know, I don't think so. And I think, you know, we need to come up with creative ways rather than expand this program. We need to look at ways that encourage local ownership. And I think one major way to do that is to not have the corporate piece and really focus this where you said it. You want it. You want to have it that residents and people that are disadvantaged, you know, just have it for those folks. And, you know, I think that's rather than expand it to try to recapture the program where it's failed in the way it was sold, what you need to do is just narrow it down so that folks that are your friends and neighbors that you know, hold these beliefs, that want to have this energy and own this energy and benefit from this energy, live right here in your state, live right by your neighbors that you see when you walk your dog, that they can participate. So
I'd ask you to support that.
Members, I don't see anybody else on the list. A6 is before you. The author of the bill suggests a no vote because of the Commerce Clause. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposition say no.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Members, we're now on A8. Is someone going to offer A8?
Madam Chair, I will offer A8. And to the author, on page 5, line 17, I guess I'm surprised by the language, and my amendment basically takes the 10% of its capacity to be used by residential subscribers and push it up to 70%. I guess I want to bring the members' attention back to the graph that we saw earlier today about the middle box and how currently what Xcel is seeing on the subscribers is 13% of the residential whole. So they're seeing that there's not a lot of residentials on it. This part of the bill actually brings down more residential use, and I'm surprised and shocked that the author would actually like to see less residential. And I was looking for some response for the author on this. I think it's I'm open to a number, but I think it should be at least higher, and something we should promote residential customers to be higher than the current usage. And why you want to bring it down, it seems and it looks like we're just supporting more billionaires to purchase bigger chunks of it. And I'd like to just get a kind of an idea of what the intent of the author's move was at on that.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker. This language was taken directly from the Senate language that passed in a bipartisan vote last session, and so I'm trying to stick with language that's worked once before and stick with the bipartisan vote from the Senate last session.
Madam Chair, and to the author, was that right then? Is that something that you agree with? Because fundamentally, I don't think it's what I'm hearing in our testimony from a lot of folks that this is the right way to go. So it sounds like if the Senate's not going to have a bill, let's send the right number over anyway, so that we believe the residentials, this is what this program was designed to do at the very beginning. So I would encourage us to do the right thing now, just because the Senate isn't involved anymore.
Members, I don't see anybody on the list.
Madam Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment just to keep moving things along. Thank you.
Thank you. So next we have A9. Is somebody going to offer A9?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the A9.
Okay. Representative Nelson offers A9. Would you explain the amendment?
Yeah, this amendment would take the cap of 225 megawatt and put it down to a 25 megawatt and really kind of put a meaningful cap on the solar gardens. We heard testimony from Xcel this week that there is quite a lot of generating capacity at present, and you know, if this surplus continues at for several years, you know, it's going to continue to make that wedge a lot bigger and really could put a sour taste in the mouth of the of what clean energy is. And if we put a meaningful cap on there, we can get utility rate solar down in that 3.5 cent range. We can move forward a lot faster on clean energy.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we heard from testifiers earlier in the week about the importance of the community solar and program to our solar jobs in the state, and I think this would really gut the program and cost us a lot of jobs that are important for a new emerging developing industry. So I would oppose the amendment.
Don't see any other names on the list. A9 is before you, members. The author of the bill suggests a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those say nay.
No.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. And now we are on A11.
Moving along, Madam Chair, I'll take that one. I wanted to take our members back to the conversation that Dr. Chan presented to us a couple days ago regarding this wedge and this conversation about the value of solar. And I think it was, I think my comment too was, my concern is the wedge is getting too big. That is literally going to blow this whole program up. And when I, as a Republican, sit here, and I've been on the committee since I've been here for 6 years, what I saw the first year I got here when the majority switched was a lot of fixing what they really thought were the outrageous things that they found weren't working before I got here. And I see this is one of those programs where if it ever fixes, and I think even back then when Chair Mahoney was running the committee, he had even made a comment that, you know what, the Made Minnesota program wasn't really right either. And I think there was that we had to really fix it hard. This is going to be that program, folks, if we don't start talking about the wedge, because the wedge is going to ruin the program for everybody. It's going to make it so that what Representative Groffel was talking about today and the insanity of what we're allowing to have the costs passed on to XL ratepayers. We're seeing in the other chart that we all were handed out yesterday, too, on the back of this one, almost 25% of the fuel charges are only producing 3% of the energy. And if we look at the biomass number in 2015, we saw 13% of the cost of the fuel charge on everybody's electric bills with XL Energy was producing 2% of the energy on the grid. Now, and again, and actually let's go back to 2015, the solar gardens weren't even on the market yet. They weren't here. Today, in 2020, 21% of the fuel charge is solar gardens, and it's producing 3% of the energy on the grid. Because of our actions in the biomass in 2020, we pushed that cost down to 5% because we shut a plant down in Benson that I didn't want to do, but it was the right thing to do because we saved ratepayers over $700 million over that 10-year period of ending that contract and that program early. It was hard, but it was the right thing to do, but we were going to come back and help these folks, and we're still working on that. But members, if we don't do something about this complete reversal in what makes any sense, the 2020 costs of 21% of the fuel charge only producing 3% of the energy, that to me was this aha moment of why this isn't working. And the wedge on this graph that was handed out tonight now was what Dr. Chan was talking about. You've got the value of solar, you've got the applicable retail rate, and it's noted that the value of solar softened it, as Representative Long has shared, it has softened it a bit. But still, from the cost of large-scale solar at the bottom, the gray one, you can see this is still a very large wedge in the whole program. So, members, I just wanted to make it so that this amendment is saying, look, we see a value, we see a percentage. I think that giving a 15% above that large-scale solar is worth these projects. I think it pencils out for a lot of folks. I'd like to just ask the author that tighten this wedge down and have it really mean something, but we're still going to give developers a 15% bonus, a 15% extra, because they can do it on a solar garden. And this isn't talking about changing the percentage of a commercial subscriber taking 40% of it. It's a 15%er. That's a good thing. So with that, I'd like to present this with a 15% kicker. I think it's a very good deal, but it tightens up the big wedge that we're seeing is literally going to end up breaking the whole program up when others get a hold of this thing. So that would be my amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker. The 115% is based off of the cost of utility-scale solar that began operation in the previous year. Last year, was zero utility-scale solar built in the state of Minnesota. So 115% of zero is zero, and I don't think zero is a fair tariff rate, so I have to oppose the amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, for Representative Long, would you like to have something where in writing you can see what the RFPs are, what actually they're delivered in other states, so we can get a number that still shows that premium? I just, you know, because we don't have that utility scale built and up and running, but we know exactly what it does cost to do it. I think we've heard that in testimony many times. We shouldn't just wait till that happens until we fix this. We can actually fix it now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I stated, this amendment would result in a $0 tariff. The value of solar rate is a rate that I support because I believe that it results in no cross-subsidy, and that's was the intent of the Public Utilities Commission in developing it. So I would not oppose, I would not support getting rid of the value of solar rate.
Representative Swazinski.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think it's interesting, you know, the comment was that there was no utility solar built in Minnesota. Was that the comment of the author of the bill? You know, I think we should all ask ourselves why that might be. Do you think it might be that we have a bill that lays before us that is acting as it was never intended to do? And when we talk about the value of solar, what is it doing? It's displacing utility rate solar in its production. I mean, we don't need more solar today. We already have a glut in the market. That's why you're trying to move this out of the twin, you know, out of the contiguous cities to find other places to stick it in. I mean, you know, I think this is some common ground. You know, I like to negotiate. I don't always like to pay what folks are asking for something. And oftentimes, you know, finding some middle ground. And as politicians and folks that are public servants, you know, I think that should be all of our goals. Let's find the middle ground. Let's not just peg it at the most expensive. Because, you know, a lot of times when someone's asking an overinflated price for something, it doesn't sell. And if you're unwilling to come down and meet in the middle, you just don't sell it. It's just on your shelf. But here's what's broken about this program, is that rather than negotiate, rather than come to some place in between, we've asked elected politicians with the influence of outside influence and big corporations and folks from all over the country that like this program, that don't want to negotiate, that don't want to find common ground. I mean, Representative Baker's amendment is a good one. It's not saying that, hey, you guys are utility rate solar, we're going to give you that price. It's saying it's understanding that you're trying to do a little something different. And fine, but let's find some common ground. Let's not have bureaucrats and politicians come in and hold the scale down for an archaic price when it comes to solar. I mean, that's essentially what it is. I mean, the life cycle of solar has changed so differently since this program's begun. It's an archaic price in just 4 or 5 or 6 short years. Like, technology changes. That's what we talked a lot about last year, Representative Wagenius, is technology changes, the market changes. Let's capture that. Let's enjoy the fruits of those labors of those scientists, those innovators that have brought the cost of this thing down. And let's let people enjoy the fruits of that. So I would ask you to support Representative Baker's amendment. Thank you.
Members, A11 is before you. The author of the bill suggests a no vote. All those in favor of A11 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
An amendment is not adopted. We are now on A13. Is someone going to offer that?
Madam Chair, I'm going to withdraw that amendment.
A13 has now been withdrawn. We are now on A10. Does somebody want to offer A10?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll do that.
Representative Fulk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Long, there's a false narrative out there that bigger is always better. And with that in mind, I offer the A10 amendment, which seeks to delete the increase in size from 1 to 3 megawatts. As an environmental professional for the past 20 years, I've been working to try to correct the mindset that bigger is better. And with that, I mean, people will always say, well, if 5 pounds of fertilizer is good, 50 pounds ought to be better. And they're over-applying fertilizer, and we're having runoff of nutrients, which is impacting surface water bodies and things like that. So bigger isn't always better. In this case, I think 3 times bigger may also mean 3 times more expensive. So I want to trim that back down to the 1 megawatt, which is a manageable size.
Representative Bowe.
I think, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Bowe. I unfortunately have to oppose the amendment. I think that this is designed to be a compromise from some of the initial sizing that the Public Utilities Commission had at 5 megawatts. There's been an interest in trying to help bring down costs, and having more scale can help control costs. So I would oppose the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kaczynski is first.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the author's, explanation of trying to lower the cost. Is there anyone from the industry that could share with the committee exactly what those costs are
so that we could understand the difference between 1 and 3 when it comes to the development?
Madam Chair, we're not on public testimony. We're on amendments.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Long, have you had any conversations with some of the developers, and have they shared any specifics on the ability for them to save money from moving us from 1 to 3 megawatts in, as far as their cost structure when it comes to providing this energy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Swazinski, I have had conversations with developers who have said that larger scale is cheaper to develop. I think that's pretty common sense. It happens in most industries. If you're able to take advantage of economies of scale, then you can bring the cost down.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will the ratepayers be able to enjoy the cost savings in that?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The subscribers will, because mm-hmm. the subscribers will be able to have the advantage of a cheaper program or a cheaper project.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, no, they won't. You're tripling the size of it. You want to go to 3 megawatts for a farm versus 1 megawatt. You're tripling the size, and if we're still going to be using the value of solar, which has nothing to do with the cost of solar, you're going to make the 21% cost of the fuel charge to be 60%, and we're going to create 9% of the fuel of the on the grid. It doesn't pencil out in any way possible. It is taking it, and I hate giving credit to Representative Garofalo's statement about putting the pedal to the metal. I hope he's listening. But it is absolutely going the wrong way, tripling the size of what this is happening and how this is working. We are going to have a huge growth in jobs in the solar market. There's no doubt about it. There are going to be folks all over the country coming to Minnesota because of this, printing money on the backs of Xcel Energy customers. If any of these amendments would work, it might be this one, because we should not be growing it to triple the size in this case. When I have heard many people have shared with me after these meetings and in between, and hey, nice comments, good idea, and these are from the solar developers. You're bringing up some really good points. But I think that they're all seeing these graphs. You cannot argue the logic. You can't make this stuff up. But yet we want to triple it and we want to pour it on. I feel honestly, and I think my friends and colleagues on the other side, when others were talking to you about what is really happening here, this is a moment in utility scale of utility world in Minnesota that. We're at a pivotal moment, because we're going to wake up in 10 years, and we're going to say, what happened to the utility rates in Minnesota? And we all have been talking about PBMs a lot of time. We all know what that is now, PBMs. A couple years ago, we didn't know what that was. In healthcare, they're in the middle, and they've ruined a lot of good stuff. This is EBMs, energy benefit managers. Start thinking of it this way, because, folks, this is what this is. We are falsely allowing them to inflate the pricing. They are making gobs of money. Rich people are getting richer, and our folks are paying a lot more money because of new EBMs that are being created right now under our own noses in Minnesota. So I'm trying to talk in a language that maybe we can hear and understand better, because energy is complicated. But I'm trying to get the attention that tripling the size of this program is the wrong way to go. So I support this amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Members, A10 is before you. The author of the bill suggests a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
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 The amendment is not adopted. Is anyone going to offer A15?
Well, we'll withdraw the A15, Madam Chair.
Okay. A15 has been withdrawn. There is a D3 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to withdraw the D3 amendment.
D3 has been withdrawn. There is the last amendment, which is A18. Is anybody going to offer that?
Madam Chair, I would be delighted to offer the A18 as the final amendment for this evening's festivities. This amendment would subject the community solar garden program to a legislative audit. You know, I think when you think of nonpartisan, when you think of fair, open, honest legislative review, I think you think of the OLA, and that's what I think. You know, this, I think, you know, by having a neutral party that involves itself with this program, where oversight, I do believe, is absolutely necessary. Just understanding, you know, we talked a little bit, you know, Representative Long talked about, you know, well, we need to expand the program by the amount of size so that it can be cheaper, right? Okay, well, let's know that. I think those are important things for us to be able to dig in, and I would just encourage, you know, Representative, I mean, this essentially, you know, I think Representative Baker kind of brought up an interesting point when he talked about the PBMs a little bit like that. But, you know, this is essentially like insulin, right? We talked a lot about that insulin's a old product. It should be cheaper, right? Why is it so expensive? Because of probably outside influence. I mean, this is an opportunity. If you took a stand the other day against expensive insulin, you should take a stand against, you know, illegitimately high-priced solar. And I think we need to know why it's high-priced and what are the costs. We know what the costs of all other solar and programs and things. Let's let the OLA jump into this in a neutral way and let them take a look at it. And I'd ask for your support on this amendment.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Brzezinski. I oppose the amendment. I think that this is information that we currently have access to and we can currently evaluate the program, and I don't believe we need the involvement of the legislative auditor.
Okay, members, A18 is before you. The author of the bill suggests a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition say no?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. I don't see any other folks on it. Are you on the list?
Yeah, I'm on the list.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like me to speak?
Yes.
All right, thank you. I just want to just share just a last few thoughts. You know, as you know, we grow in our knowledge of energy policy in the state, I think it's important to really kind of dig down, you know, kind of move past, you know, some of the flashy things, the dollars, the developers, and really get down to business of saying, you know, what is this program? I mean, oftentimes when we talk about bills, we hear from Lyndon Carlson of he'll say, well, you know, this is what we were thinking when this passed many years ago, right? And one of the things that we've heard over and over and over when it comes to this particular bill is it's way more successful from one perspective than we ever expected. But from another perspective, it's not really operating like anyone expected it to. It's way bigger. It's costing the ratepayers of an Excel territory an exceptional amount of money that it was never intended to do. And yet, what does this bill do? Let's make it bigger. Let's keep kind of the status quo in many parts of it. Let's change some other parts so that maybe we can encourage the bill to do what was maybe initially intended. You know, while there's a lot of folks that are outside this room and inside this room that have a lot of influence. And, you know, I would just, you know, encourage you, you know, to look at that chart for one thing. You know, that bar chart, that wedge of solar prices that Representative Baker, you know, talked about. Is it necessary? You know, we had a couple of good amendments that, you know, kind of came to that middle ground that maybe allowed, you know, some shared cost between the two. But, you know, let's work on those things. I think, you know, if this bill is to move forward, it sounds like it's dead on arrival in the Senate. But we all know that there is always life within any bill before we're out of here. So, you know, I think let's find some common ground. You know, creating a new community access program under the old retail rate will increase the cost of this program for ratepayers. You know, I think XL ratepayers, we are already subsidizing over 650 megawatts with no ends in sight. I mean, this bill doesn't have an end date. It doesn't have caps, real caps. You know, I think we have an opportunity to ask folks around the state what they really want. Is this what they want? I know there's some people that want this, but there's others that don't. I think repealing the contiguous counties provision, I really think, you know, it just kind of is that little death throw that, you know, deep down you feel guilty saying, you know what, this really isn't about community. This is about corporations. And, you know, I'm saying that as a Republican, just right there. But, I mean, is that what you really want? Is that what you want? You know, folks, I think, you know, we have an opportunity to do good legislative work and allow for families and community members to invest if that's what they want to do. But this bill diverges from the burgeoning place that this was came out, you know, 7 years ago. And it's turned it on its head and blew it up. And, you know, I would encourage you folks to, you know, send it back to the drawing board. You know, we had a couple of good amendments that are giving you that chance, but we didn't quite have enough votes. So I'd ask you to vote no.
I don't see anyone else on the list. Oh, I'm sorry.
And I'd like a roll call, too, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Baker first.
I'm sorry. I did want to just make a quick comment after our lead, and I apologize, Representative Swedzinski.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, thanks for the roll call. I do want to make sure it's on the record, because I think we try to do something very simple with putting graphs together with color and the whole thing to show 350% more in power is what we're charging folks that could be paying a lot less for solar, because I think we all like solar. One comment I want to make all the time, or that I've been was hearing a lot, was the reason we come up with the value of solar is all the avoided costs. And I think what we're forgetting is if we are avoiding the cost of building a new plant, sure, that's great. We're not building any new transmission lines to this place to get it on the grid. That's right. But we've already paid for that with all of our investments over the decades throughout our utility bills. So why do we have to pay for it twice? So these avoided costs are just all extras going into developers' pockets. I can't wait someday to get on this thing where we can reverse it and kill this program like it needs to be done. So I hope that developers that hear this just know this is not the program that they should invest in long term. This is not the right idea. And I look forward to having this more conversation on the House floor. Thank you.
Representative Long, would you like to
respond? Yes, briefly. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate everybody's engagement on this bill. We've talked about it, community solar program, a lot last year and a lot this year, and I know it's a dense topic, and I appreciate everybody's engagement and attention. I think if we learn one thing today, it's fair to say that the bill as drafted is not going to pass the Senate. And so I think that you all are very safe in voting for this bill and getting to conference so that we can actually have a negotiation. We have two choices at this point. We can have the status quo, or we can have a negotiation to try to help stabilize the program and address some of the concerns that you all have raised. And that's my goal. I'm trying to get to conference. I'm trying to see if we can work together to find some compromises here. Xcel testified earlier today that they're having productive conversations with solar developers. I'm hoping those conversations continue, and I'm hoping that we can get to conference and come up with a good outcome for Minnesotans.
Thank you. Representative Long, we're going to take a roll call on Representative Long's motion that House File 3368, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Swedzinski?
No.
Representative Akam?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Nope.
Representative Bierman?
Yes.
Representative Bowe?
No.
Representative Christensen?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo? Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Meckland?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Stevenson?
Yes.
There are 8 ayes and 5 nays, so the bill is passed and we refer to Ways and Means. We have the minutes of February 25th. Yeah. Representative Stevenson, would you move those minutes?
So moved.
All those in favor of the minutes of February 25th, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you guys for a vigorous day.
Yeah.
Thank you. Meeting's adjourned.